know, I wasn't feeling very good yesterday. 4 weeks after President Bush went to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudi Arabians to sell us more oil, our weakness, that we would be able to consume, our Secretary of Energy had to go back again yesterday on 1 week's notice in order to beg again for the Saudi Arabians to please sell us and sell the rest of the world more oil, more fossil fuels that we can burn. And the Saudi Arabians said, as part of this deal, we want you to sell us nuclear power plants that we can use here in Saudi Arabia. Send us the nuclear materials. Now, my own feeling is that if President Bush and Condoleezza Rice 4 weeks ago had looked up into the sky, or Secretary Biden yesterday, they might have noticed this blazing sun coming down on the desert of Saudi Arabia. And perhaps we should have had a solar technology exchange program with Saudi Arabia as part of this deal, because ultimately, as Dr. Hansen said, that's where we have to head. But unfortunately, this administration still does not, you know, have that perspective and is still blocking the Democratic Congress's ability to move the tax cuts for solar and renewables and wind and others onto the books on a permanent basis. It's kind of a sad moment here in America yesterday. But Dr. Hansen actually is this ray of sunshine keeps coming through, giving us hope, and I think he has really helped to transform the debate. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and then I see Jay Inslee here and other members, and ask them if they would like to ask Dr. Hansen any questions, and then open it up to other people if they do have something that they would like to ask him. So my first question to you is, you stated that so far we've only actually seen one half of the effects of the greenhouse gases that have already been sent up into the atmosphere. And we know that a huge percentage of that greenhouse gas pollution is red, white, and blue CO2. What do you believe is the estimates of the increase in the temperature in Fahrenheit that we're likely to see as a result of what is already up there?
Yeah, that depends on how long you wait. By the way, I forgot to do, I just slipped my last chart. I did write up a 4-page summary statement, which I didn't find about this. But to answer your question, yes. If we wait long enough for the ocean to warm up, we could expect about 1 degree Fahrenheit additional global warming. We've had now 0.8 degrees Celsius, which is 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit so far in the last century. But there are also, that is including just the delay of the ocean and the so-called fast feedback process. But as the forest begin to move forward, and they are already beginning to do that in Canada and Siberia. And as the ice sheets begin to get darker due to more melt in the summer and begin to shrink, then we get slow feedbacks coming into play. If you wait for those, then the forming in the pipeline is even larger by a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And that takes longer. We don't know exactly how long we've been before us. We're already over the time scale of a century or so.
Now, you said in the presentation that 350 parts per million of CO2 is all that the planet can really tolerate. We're already above 350 parts. How long can the planet tolerate over 350 parts per million, and what role the manifestation of the impacts of that?
Yeah, that's the $64 question. And that's what we call it, not the, it's a dynamical question. It's the equations governing it and the processes governing it are nonlinear, which means it's an ice sheet collapse, for example. You begin, things are going slowly, you're losing mass, but as it begins to disintegrate, the surface gets lower. That's a positive feedback because it's warmer, the temperature falls off the height. And you can imagine that once it does begin to collapse, then things will go very fast. You don't want to get to the point where you pass that tipping point. And the truth is, you don't know if you want to do that. Suspicion is, well, you can get by some decades. But I can't imagine that you could go centuries and still expect the ice sheets to be stable. And unfortunately, I can't answer that as well as I'd like to, but I think what's going to happen is that in the next several years, decade or so, we're going to see things accelerate, and people are going to see it. And then we're going to start thinking, well, how can we drop down to CO2? And then we've got to try to do these things, reforestation, agricultural policies that reward farmers, the practices that store carbon in the soil, and I just hope we start doing that soon enough.
And could you talk a little bit about the renewable energy revolution and how you feel about the solar potential on the planet, what you would make as a recommendation to the Congress and to the world with regard to each one of the renewable technologies that you think offer the most potential for getting us there as
staff
that is human.
Yeah, I think that's, again, the caveat is that I would let the marketplace work, because I have a feeling that there are more innovations out there. And once you get that carbon price, I think we'll find improvements and things will go faster. But already we've reached the point that solar thermal is a viable source of electric power, and if we had a low loss grid, we could provide actually the majority of the U.S. electrical needs just for solar thermal. I'm not certain there may be other things that would be competitive, and wind is certainly has the potential to be a significant player. But as I mentioned, I think that grid is important for renewables. That's the one that has already reached a stage I think is ready to make major contributions to the state.
Thank you, Dr. Congressman Jay Inslee from the state of Washington.
Thank you, Dr. Inslee. I think we've discovered one benefit of global warming. If you talk about it for 20 years, you stay eternally young. So I don't know.
Years ago, I had you.
We haven't lost anything much. We really appreciate your 2 decades of service. You've been at this for 2 decades, and we've made marginal to no progress. Why do you believe we're capable of cleaning this cap? And what should be our short-term goal, 2020-2025? I'm actually more interested in what we can do now and sort of this decade. But why do you think we're going to do this after 2 years of sort of fruitless advocacy, and what should be our target metric?
Well, I think that it's a mistake. The community has kind of focused on these percentage numbers, but I point out one thing about the setting the percentage goal. There is a difference between oil CO2 and coal CO2. In that I don't see how we're going to prevent, we can slow down the oil, but we're not going to prevent it. In the case of, and coal is one that we could prevent. So I think the most important near-term thing is to say, let's have a moratorium on coal. Any new coal-fired power plants until we have the technology to capture that would be my immediate thing that I think should happen. But also then it's getting the process in place, because you want to affect people's choices, their lifestyle choices. And so the way you do that naturally is via a carbon price. Somebody has got to have the guts to stand up in front of the public and tell them that in order for this to work, and they can explain it, that there needs to be a carbon price. If we had started with a carbon price several years ago, we would have $4 a gallon of gas, but most of that $4 would be staying in the U.S. as a carbon tax, and it would be going back to the citizens if you had a tax and dividend, rather than going to Saudi Arabia or someplace. You have to, I think the public can understand that sort of thing, and it would, but you can't instantly make those changes. You have to give time for infrastructure to be replaced. So it's more getting that process going that I think we have to, can't wait longer. And then, as I mentioned, this grid, that is the thing. But the president could say, we're going to do it this decade. And we could do it this decade.
By the way, help is on the way here. The Republicans control the presidency, the House, and Senate for 6 years. The Congress for 12 years. But the head of the EPA did not appear before the environmental committee and the House of Representatives for 6 years, all 6 years of the Bush presidency and the Republican control of the House. In fact, the head of the EPA has been in the most successful witness detection program in the history of the United States. Very few people even know his name. Speaker Pelosi created this Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming as the only new entity, the only new Select Committee that she would create in order to focus on the passage of legislation that would increase the fuel economy of the vehicles which we drive. And in December, we moved that from 25 to 35 miles per gallon for the first time since 1975, believe it or not. We actually increased it 27 miles per gallon in 1986 because of the 1975 law, but increasing the efficiency of the appliances that we use, the buildings that we live in. So it's a lot more work to accomplish. And a climate change bill, putting a price on carbon, is without question the indispensable part of the ultimate solution to this problem. Are there questions? Yes, over here, could you identify yourself and ask your question?
My name's Elizabeth Dunning. I was wondering if you thought that.
And where are you from?
The Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee.
That's great.
Do you think that the environmental costs of alternative energies like nuclear power and ethanol outweigh the environmental advantages?
Well, I think that biofuels, there is potential for biofuel to be a positive contribution to this problem, but certainly the way it's done now is actually not. Corn-based ethanol is more harm than good, but there are ways to have biofuels using low input, high diversity, natural grasses, and no-till agriculture. You can come up with biofuels that are helpful. And in fact, we may want to burn biofuels in a power plant, capture the CO2 and sequester it. That way, it would be a negative CO2 contribution. We would actually, plants would be drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere. We burn the biofuels and put the CO2 beneath ocean sediments where it's inherently stable. We may have to do things like that to draw down CO2, but that biofuel is part of your question. The other one was about
nuclear energy.
Nuclear should be allowed to compete. It's actually very expensive, and it does have problems that have not been solved. Although I think the next generation nuclear, if we would, if our government would solve the waste disposal, could be a contributor. But my guess is, frankly, that renewables, if we would have a low loss electricity, renewables could be a big problem. But again, I've let them compete.
Question from many? Yes, sir. Could you identify yourself?
Matt Germaning. I'm with Representative Jerry Costello's office. As we begin the process to switch into more renewable energy sources away from coal and carbon, what type of shocks to our system would you expect that we need to be prepared for?
I think that it's one of the shocks would be clean atmosphere. Reduction of mercury pollution, which is making it dangerous to eat human fish. And I think more better jobs. You know, coal mining is not a great job. So it is going to change lifestyles in some way. It's carbon price, it may affect things like the fact that we import food from halfway around the world. Maybe we'll start using our neighborhood farms more. If transportation fuel has to pay its cost, right now we're subsidizing fossil fuels and there's no tax on aviation fuel, so we import food from New Zealand. There'll be a lot of changes, but they'll work themselves through the system.
Question?
Okay, yes, sir.
What about China? The last 100 years, the CO2 emissions have been moving up. The next 30 years, we're all involved from China, and it will actually be as much as we did in the last 100 years.
China, as you know, we are the source of the present problem. The greenhouse effect is caused by the gases that are in the atmosphere now, and not by today's emissions, but by the integrated emissions over time. And we have produced more than three times more than the second country, which is China. And on a per capita basis, it's more than a factor of 10 discrepancies. So we should not scapegoat them. But they will need to be part of the solution, and they certainly will be. They would like nothing better than to get rid of dirty fossil fuels. And it's our advantage to get moving fast, so we'll have the technology to sell to them. But they're eager to find clean energies, and they would suffer more from the climate change than we would. They've got a few hundred million people living close to sea level.
Quick follow-up. Have you ever had a chance to sit down with a big coal? I know you've shut down the facility, but I mean with the people actually extracting stuff. I think some of the people in the world hang out afterwards.
I did get a talk several years ago to a coal group and a real group. And that was before things had reached this point where we're really at nearly tipping point. Where I started to call for a moratorium with my power plants. But coal should, if we capture all the pollutants, including CO2, then I think coal can remain an option. I frankly think that we will find a long run. And in the long run, by the way, the reserves for coal have probably been greatly exaggerated. There are recent studies, as yet unpublished, that show that part of the reason for the increase in coal costs is that we're beginning to have to go deeper to get the coal. And it's a finite resource, so we've got to think beyond fossil fuel for a long time. And I just think that these companies, oil and coal companies, should start investing their huge resources in clean energy. And become energy companies rather than fossil fuels.
Hi, Dan Novak from the Washington Post. I'm very interested in your emphasis on coal as opposed to oil, seeming to say that it's pretty much a lost cause anyway. You're not talking a lot about hybrids and fuel cells. Would it be better off? I mean, in the popular imagination, global warming is all about what we're driving. Would we be better off worrying less about that and worrying more about the
Well, we're going to have to worry about what we're driving because oil is so cheap. We've been using it at an incredible rate. We're going to have to. So energy efficiency is going to be essential. So the kind of increases that we're working in efficiency are very important because we're going to have to get that energy someplace. And maybe it will be through electric, but maybe it will be through biofuels, some combination, but it's going to be always energy is a premium. And oil is important in the sense that we insist on going to all corners of the earth, to the deepest ocean, to the Antarctica, Arctic, getting every last drop of oil we can find. That would be a mistake. But that could push us beyond the tipping point. We should rather be moving to more of the post-petroleum economy. So there is some importance, but I just say we can't prevent the big, easily available oil and super deposits that Saudi Arabia and Russia have. That's going to end up in the next.
Yes, sir.
Question is for you. What
do
you
expect?
Sorry, Jeff Young with the public radio program, Losing America. What do you make of Dr. Hansen's statement that the CEOs of major energy companies might be responsible for trying to get you down? Do you agree with that?
I do agree with Dr. Hansen that the fossil fuel industry is especially engaged in a systematic pattern of misleading the American public about the science of global warming. And I believe that as a result, from their perspective, the fossil fuel industry, that Dr. Hansen became public enemy number one. So the science that Dr. Hansen had created, the warnings that he had given, led to a counter response from the fossil fuel industry. And to the extent to which we are now at a tipping point. There is not much time left, and yet they continue to press towards the continued increased use of fossil fuels, then we have a problem. If you want to put a fine point on it, ExxonMobil last year made $40 billion. It used $32 billion of that to buy back its own stock. It only spent $10 million on universe. Now, if you look at their advertisements on 24/7 on every cable and broadcast station, in amounts that exceed $10 million, that is the buy, you would think that they were the greenest company in the world. So I think this is a continued pattern of disinformation. We've seen it over the last 20 years. I think it's going to continue. And I think when history comes back to ultimately determine who was responsible, I think it will be that rather than accepting the science and making the modifications, they continue to fight this rearguard action. And we're still seeing it on this renewable tax credit issue and on the issue of whether or not there should be a national standard for renewable electricity generation in our country. That was defeated in the Senate by one vote in December. Unfortunately, that wasn't the Senate obtained vote. But it was driven by the lobbying efforts of the oil and gas and coal industry. So it's a pretty sad moment here, where you know the technology is there, the warnings from the United Nations, they won the Nobel Prize along with Al Gore. And that's a big moment in and of itself. I mean, when Al Gore wins the Nobel Prize and an Oscar for a slideshow, basically reinforcing with Dr. Hansen's been saying for the last 20 years, you know that debate is over, except in the minds of these executives, that if they can continue to cloud this debate, they believe they can buy more years. But as Dr. Hansen said, we don't have those years. So yes, I do agree. Yes.
Hi, my name is
Kylie.
I'm from the Center for American Progress. And Dr. Hansen, I was just wondering, you mentioned that you see the youth and nature versus the oil companies and their executives. I'm just wondering what more you think the
youth
movement
can do. Well, they can do a lot. Jessie Tolkien is sitting here. She's one of the youth leaders. There's a coalition of, I think, 47 youth organizations that are taking this as, I think, their top priority in the near term, and they intend to try to influence the democratic process in this next issue. And register more young voters and get this issue more attention. And I think that's very important because there are a number of people in our Congress who are clearly more influenced by special interests, by special fossil fuel interests, than they are by concerns about what planet we're leaving for our children and grandchildren. So that's, I think the first thing is to influence the democratic process, but also because of the critical role of coal, it's possible for youth organizations to also influence. We've got to stop individual coal plants until we can get a general moratorium. So those are
Jesse Avia has a tremendous movement that she's running. She is a Latter-day suffragette that put together a movement. They changed the laws for America so that women could run, those young freedom riders that went to the South to make sure that minorities could vote, and now this green generation led by Jesse and her organization of rising up. And, Congress is a stimulus response institution. And there's nothing more stimulating than millions of young green generation voters saying that that's how they're going to vote. And this election is moving very rapidly in that direction. Questions from anybody? Yes.
I'm Corinne Hutlack from the Civil Society Institute, and I've noticed your optimism in the development of technology to capture carbon and sequester carbon. But yet I have read some scientists believe that this cannot be developed in time to be really useful, and in the meantime, we will continue to have coal plants functioning, even if there's a moratorium on new plants.
Well, I frankly think that renewables will drive coal out of business once we have a reasonable carbon price. I think you have to allow the competition, and there are many reasons why it actually makes sense to be coal in the ground and avoid mountain top removal and stream pollution. But on the near term, this technology could have been ready now. The world didn't really want it because it's so much, you make so much more money burning coal without it, that they've just used that as this clean coal dream as propaganda and not really worked on it. It took 7 years to decide where they're going to make the future again, and then they canceled the project. So there wasn't a great enthusiasm. There's enough potential in energy efficiency that we don't need new coal-fired power plants while we're working on the energies of the future. We just have to tap that efficiency. And a carbon price is one of the key things that we can do.
Just want to reinforce the point that Dr. Hans made. In 2007, in the United States, 35% of all new electricity came from coal. Only 10% came from coal. 55% came from natural gas, 1% from solar, and 1% from low-end hydro. So if we can get that number up, solar and wind up to 40%, 50%, 60%, 70%, if we can get the national standards on the books, if we can get over this Republican objection to us putting these tax breaks on the books permanently, we can see a revolution in 4 or 5 years that 70% of our electricity coming from wind and solar and other renewables, and that will pretty much end this era of new coal-fired plants. Yes?
Eric Felice from Time Magazine. Dr. Hanson, what price do you think we'll have to see for carbon before we are in the clean energy economy right now? I think there's an equivalent price of about $40 per ton in Europe, and yet they're still talking about new coal-fired plants. So what do you think the price has to be to really drive the change?
You know, I can't really give you a number, not an expert on that, but I can tell you that's why you probably need a substantial price, and that's why the tax at 100% dividend, I think, is important, because the public really objects to a new tax, if that's all it is, even if it's a green tax. Even in Germany, there's a small addition of green tax. But if they're getting all the money back, not Congress deciding where the money is being spent, then I think they will allow, or many of them will even encourage an increase in the tax rate. Does it mean they'll actually get more money?
Yes, ma'am?
Maura Bachner, the American Geological Institute. My question is about the possibility of a future climate change bill, because now in the popular political climate, there's a great clamor for change, and I've been hearing a lot about the likelihood of such a bill passing in the next Congress. And I was wondering what your opinion was of a bill that would negotiate the science a little bit, so not be passed on robust science.
I don't quite understand that.
I think your question is, would he mind if there was a compromise on the science and I'm going to get a bill passed?
Yes, that's my question. Well,
a compromise on the science? What does that mean?
As in
on the targets
for the CO2 emissions.
Well, you know, the target, the bills that were discussed recently really were not adequate. But it's more the approach that I think is not appropriate. I think that setting the goal of X percent reduction by 2050 or by 2030 or other dates are really, first of all, because their goals are not really enforceable, is really not the way to go. I think that, as you said a few times, you have to cut off the cool seas. And we have to encourage efficiency via the carbon price. And both, do other things. There are many things that Congress can do, like changing the rules for utilities so that they can make more money by selling less energy, by helping consumers be more efficient, rather than making more money by selling more energy. I think those fundamental type of changes are what we need, rather than goals that we compromise on the way they were discussed in the last week. I just found that whole debate to be not very fruitful, but I just don't think it's fruitful.
Yes, sir, back over here.
Nick Palmer, Methodist Internal Select Committee. Dr. Hanson, you spoke about a moratorium on coal-fired power plants, but I was curious as to, I guess, like what would be the best political way to sell that idea, because coal is, you know, present in about 15 or so states right now in the United States. That's 30 senators. I think they're very difficult states to sell, especially after all the Senate side. What do you suggest to, you know, our cause, I guess, in order to do that?
Yeah, well, those states are also affected. Yeah, it's a hard problem in the U.S. because, and you know, I just went over to Germany and was talking to the German environmental minister. They had the same problem there. It takes leadership. I think, it would require the new president to really understand what the problem is and what the steps are that are necessary to solve it. And otherwise, I don't think it would be done at a local or even a state basis. You're asking a difficult question because I'm telling you, I'm just looking at the science, at the carbon reservoirs, what has to be done. And it's very hard to dispute that. But how to do it politically is a tough problem. It would kind of happen naturally if you had a carbon price that became large enough. Then you'll just, it'll become easy to, coal is, will become uncompetitive.
But just to answer your question, in any cap-and trade bill, any climate change bill that you pass, we will build in billions of dollars of carbon capture and sequestration research, which Dr. Hansen is a supportive of. And we will also make sure that, at least this would be my goal, to make sure that any new coal-fired plants that were built were carbon capture and sequestration ready. That is, you couldn't build a new plant unless it had the capacity to sequester the capture the carbon. So, if Dr. Hansen seems optimistic about our ability to do that, then I think we have to invest. So, and that way we can export that technology once we discover it to China, to India, to Russia, and other countries that will continue to bring coal. We actually have a responsibility to discover that, to perfect it, and then to export the technology quickly. And I think we can do that if we get a good carbon capture bill. We'll take two more questions. We'll take one from this young lady right here.
Hi, Amy Mullins from Congress from the Attorney's Office. This is actually a question for Congressman Martin. Do you really think it's politically feasible to advocate a carbon tax, basically, when, I mean, right now the public is actually outraged at the high oil prices?
Without question, the solution can only be created. At the point at which industries that now use the skies as their garbage disposal system are made to pay a price for that. There's no question about it. We then will have to handle, as Dr. Hansen said, how we ensure that ordinary families are compensated for that. So it's not that we're sending the economic signal, in other words, to the coal, to the natural gas, the oil industry, for them to invest in new technology, but that ordinary individuals, families, will not have higher gasoline or higher electricity rates. And that's the formula that we have to construct. So the premise of your question is correct, but there is an answer to it, that unleashes a technological revolution while not having a dramatic consumer impact. And if we can get that formula, then I think it'll telescope the time frame it takes in order to get the answer. Is, you know, Bill Gates said about any technology revolution, in the short run it's overestimated, but in the long run it's underestimated. So when we passed the Telecommunications Act, and I was a co-author of that in 1996, there was a lot of hype on which it led to a dot-com bubble in the short run. But even that was an underestimation of what we have today. It's only 11 years later, whether it be Google or Amazon or YouTube and all these other revolutionary technologies, and the price of long distance has basically collapsed out of almost nothing, and cell phone service. So I think once we unleash it correctly, the industry will embrace the new technologies, and as long as we insulate the consumers, that there will not be the kind of political impact that we're talking about. We'll take one final question, and we'll take it from this gentleman back here.
Matt Plessy from Talk Radio News. Dr. Hansen, I'm wondering, you've said before that both oil companies and coal companies have misdirected the public to a criminal extent. This, you've shown that this happened with cigarette companies before now. What are specific examples that you would give, and do you think the government should intervene?
The specific examples of
contemporary
misdirection. Those are found in the literature, and I mean they still appear in the newspapers and on television. Although the messages have become more sophisticated now, you get all this greenwash. These companies are saying some of the right things, but their actions, as Congressman Markey indicated, still are such that they're not investing in renewable energies. They're still planning to make their money by selling us higher price fossil fuels. I don't really have specific examples now where I would point to a specific ad. I think there's fairly well documented
I would be, if they want to challenge this in court, well, I think it, because it would not be hard to show all the cases. Dr. Hansen is definitely reflecting what is obvious. On even last year, when my amendment to increase the fuel economy standards from 25 to 35 miles per gallon, by the way, that's the equivalent to all of the oil that we import from the Gulf itself on a daily basis. It's now the law. Toyota was part of the coalition to Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler to block that. Toyota. In 2007, selling Priuses, Camry, and this is a lot of work that has to be done politically with a lot of these industries that have benefited from this fossil fuel era. But once we get it done, we will have a revolution that equal to the challenge that Dr. Hansen has laid out for us. Let's be honest. 20 years ago, Dr. Hansen said to us that global warming was going, if unsolved, would be it would make all the other issues combined nearly a footnote if we did not solve it. And as a result, here on the 20th anniversary, we have as our special guest, before the Select Committee on Global Warming, one of the great citizens of the world. Please, if you want that.